Welcome. My name is Dr. Andrew Muir, Chief of the Division of Gastroenterology at Duke University School of Medicine. This is an IAS USA module on the treatment of hepatitis C in patients with cirrhosis. Today I will be covering the following concerns on the treatment of hepatitis C in patients with cirrhosis. This will include a discussion of the definitions and diagnostic approach, treatment, with further discussion about candidacy, efficacy, and adverse events, and then decompensated cirrhosis. On the next slide, I'd like to talk to you about a case. So this is a 54-year-old man who presents with a new diagnosis of hepatitis C. He has no history of ascites, encephalopathy, or GI bleeding. On exam, he's mentally clear, and there's no signs of ascites or edema. His laboratory data show a slightly elevated AST and ALT and a bilirubin of 1.2. His albumin is 3.9. His creatinine is normal at 1.0. His platelets are slightly reduced at 110. His PT is normal. And his HCV RNA is 1.1 million international units per mil. His genotype is 1A. So questions come up, does this patient need treatment? And other questions include, what is his stage of liver disease? So in this next section, I'd like to talk to you about the definitions and the diagnostic approach to a patient with hepatitis C. On this next slide is an outline of the natural history of hepatitis C. And we know that if we have patients who get acute hepatitis C, most will go on to develop chronic infection, but some will eradicate it by themselves. Of the patients that develop chronic infection, we believe about 20% will develop cirrhosis. Key points are there that not everyone develops cirrhosis, and we often meet people in the chronic hepatitis stage, and we're trying to anticipate if they'll progress. Also note that this is a slow timeline. This plays out over decades, and so quick decisions often don't need to be made with hepatitis C. We have time to plan, and we have time to make changes when necessary. We do know that faster progression of the natural history occurs if the patient is older at the time they get infected, if they drink alcohol, if they have HIV infection, or if they're post-transplant. On the next slide, we review the liver fibrosis staging. There are a number of different strategies that have been employed, but commonly we talk about the METAVIR staging system, and this details it here. So F1 would be someone with portal fibrosis, so very minimal. F2 is portal fibrosis with a few septa leaving the portal tracts. F3 is bridging fibrosis, so starting to bridge between portal tracts. And F4 is when we're at the stages of cirrhosis, so with well-formed nodules. And on the next slide, we talk about one of the common approaches that has been used in the past, which was liver biopsy to stage patients. And this has been the gold standard. It's obviously an invasive procedure. It does have low morbidity and mortality, but not zero. But there are some limitations with it. For one thing, we're taking a small piece of liver, so there is some sampling error that is in play. There also can be observer variability between pathologists looking at it, and it's not a small thing, and it's costly for a patient to experience. In the next slide, I talk about some of the alternatives to liver biopsy that have now become quite common. And so biopsy is not a requirement anymore for a patient with a new evaluation of hepatitis C. There are some serum markers that are used. Some of these employ standard laboratory tests, such as the APRI or FIB4, and there are apps available or websites where you can see these markers and plug in for formula to get them. So using labs that you might commonly get through your assessment. There are also commercial assays available for this. And there are radiographic tests, with the common one being used in Europe, the United States, and North America of elastography. There are some limitations to these as well. They do quite well about differentiating between cirrhosis and without cirrhosis, but they're not as good to say if someone is F1 versus F2, etc. If you're looking at serologies, they can be impacted by inflammation, and we do see indeterminate outcomes. But in general, these can be quite useful in stratifying patients for particularly the development or progression of cirrhosis. And on the next slide, the ASLD IDSA IASUSA guidance has reviewed all of this, and this group has been very helpful in guiding us about hepatitis C treatment and approaches. And their main point is that an assessment of the degree of hepatic fibrosis needs to be performed. They don't necessarily say which one. It's just important that that be factored into the care of a patient. They need some kind of evaluation. And if the patient's not treated in the near future, then there needs to be ongoing assessment for that patient. In this next session, I'd like to talk to you about the treatment options that are currently available for patients with hepatitis C cirrhosis. In this next part, I also want to talk about who needs treatment, and the AASLD-IDSA guidance has come forward with this as well. We do recommend broad treatment for patients with hepatitis C, and really except for those with short life expectancies, that we really do recommend that people move forward with hepatitis C. And if there's questions about their candidacy or need for transplant, then they need to be seen by an expert. But in general, we recommend broad treatment for liver, the treatment of their hepatitis C to prevent progression of liver disease and other complications as a result of hepatitis C. On the next slide, we have a table of the genotype 1 current treatments available that are recommended through the AASLD-IDSA guidance. And this is a very mobile process, which is why the hcbguidelines.org website is key to know, so you can keep up with the latest treatments. But at least as of the October of 2015, there were several treatments available for genotype 1. Latipivir, sofosbuvir, with and without ribavirin. Paratepravir, ambidavir, desabuvir, with and without ribavirin. Smepirivir, sofosbuvir, with and without ribavirin. And then dicladaspir, sofosbuvir, with and without ribavirin. Notice that the PEG interferon option is no longer recommended for genotype 1 patients. And notice that all of these regimens are available for naive and PEG interferon failure patients. But if a patient had previously failed a first-generation protease inhibitor or a sofosbuvir regimen, then they are limited as well. On the next slide, I want to talk about ladipivir and sofosbuvir. And there are a number of studies about this, but I think a key one for patients with cirrhosis is the SIRIUS study. So this study looked at patients who were treatment experienced and they had failed both PEG interferon ribavirin and a protease inhibitor, first-generation protease inhibitor regimen, as well as a PEG interferon ribavirin regimens in the past. So these patients all had compensated cirrhosis, so all quite stable. They were randomized, double-blinded study, and there were two treatment arms. In one, they received placebo for 12 weeks, followed by ladipivir, sofosbuvir, and ribavirin for 12 weeks. So notice the shorter duration and the addition of ribavirin there. Or ladipivir, sofosbuvir, and placebo ribavirin for 24 weeks. So no ribavirin, but longer duration. And this was nice here to be able to look at the adverse events against a placebo arm in the first 12 weeks. And when looking at the safety, it was nice to see that this group of patients did quite well, keeping in mind they do have compensated cirrhosis, they are at risk for serious adverse events, but it was 5% in the group with ribavirin versus 10% in the 24-week group without ribavirin. And the adverse events leading to discontinuation were 1% and 0%. But in general, to take away, this group did quite well with this treatment regimen. And on the next slide, we look at the efficacy outcomes and see that the two approaches did quite well at 96 and 97%. So either option looked quite reasonable here for these patients with compensated cirrhosis, either a shortened duration at 12 weeks with the addition of ribavirin or 24 weeks without ribavirin. And on the next slide, I want to talk about the treatment experience with paratepravir, boosted by ritonavir, along with ambidavir and desabuvir. So this nicely done study was a large study, 380 patients, all with Child-Pugh class A or compensated disease. They were treatment naive and previously treated, and they were treated with this regimen with ribavirin. And the main research question here was 12 versus 24 weeks. And we see that in the efficacy portion of the slide, the 12 weeks is in green and the 24 weeks is in blue, and all groups did quite well. We do see higher response rates in the genotype 1B patients. The genotype 1A patients did cross our 90% threshold there when the treatment was extended to 24 weeks, and that was recommended for genotype 1A with patients with cirrhosis. The next slide looks at the adverse event profile in this group with compensated cirrhosis, and again, they do have adverse events. These are patients with cirrhosis getting treatment, but the adverse event rate leading to discontinuation was very low at 1.9% and 2.3%. And the serious adverse event in this group was also low at 6.2 and 4.7% with one death. Now, on the next slide, it looks at the same regimen in just genotype 1B patients because the body of literature was showing that maybe genotype 1B patients did not need ribavirin, but the previous study that I showed you had included everyone getting ribavirin. So this is an open-label study, naive and experienced genotype 1B patients with compensated cirrhosis. There were 60 patients. They all received 12 weeks of the regimen without ribavirin, and all 60 achieved SVR. So that did lead to a change in the guidelines. And for genotype 1B patients with cirrhosis, they're no longer recommended to have ribavirin. Now, on this next slide, there has been another interesting development with this regimen that has come out in the fall of 2015. And there was a letter from the FDA which discussed 26 worldwide cases, 10 of which there was hepatic failure with this regimen resulting in transplantation or death, and 16 patients in which there was liver dysfunction. And we don't have data on all of these patients. These are from expanded access cases, and these are not within clinical trials. In most of the cases, it appeared the liver injury was within 1 to 4 weeks of starting the regimen. And in some of these patients, because it was not a clinical trial and expanded access scenarios, they were either contraindicated or not recommended patients. And so this is what happens when we go outside of the clinical trials domain. One of the quotes from the letter was that transaminase elevations did not appear to be a predominant presentation in the cases with advanced liver disease. It was really the bilirubin that came forward without an obvious increase in the AST and the ALT. This did lead in change to the FDA, and they've now made this regimen contraindicated in Child-Pugh B and C cirrhosis. So this highlights the need for a close review of the level of liver disease, including in patients with cirrhosis, whether they're compensated with Child-Pugh A or they've decompensated with Child-Pugh B and C. Now, shifting gears on the next slide, we want to talk about genotype 2 infection. And there have been some changes here in the recommendations. Sofosbuvir and ribavirin for 12 weeks does remain the recommended for patients who do not have cirrhosis and treatment naive. But if they have cirrhosis, it's recommended that the treatment be extended to 16 weeks. Also entering genotype 2, we now have dacladaspir and sofosbuvir, which is recommended for 12 weeks if the patient's ineligible for ribavirin. So a great option there. If the patient failed peg interferon ribavirin in the past, then sofosbuvir and ribavirin is still recommended, but it's 16 to 24 weeks for patients with cirrhosis. And also, you can consider peg interferon ribavirin and sofosbuvir for this group, as they do quite well. Now, we do have some patients who fail sofosbuvir, and if that is the case, they are not recommended to receive sofosbuvir and ribavirin again. Instead, it would be recommended that they receive, if interferon eligible, that 12 weeks of peg interferon ribavirin and sofosbuvir. If they're interferon ineligible, then it's recommended they receive dacladaspir and sofosbuvir with and without ribavirin for 24 weeks. Now, on the next slide, I have a number of studies that are all put here together just to give you a sense of the different options for patients with genotype 2 with and without cirrhosis. The blue bars are the patients without cirrhosis, and you see their rates are all quite high with a number of different options. The green are the patients with cirrhosis, and that's really where you see some of the difference. So starting on the left, we see that 12 weeks of sofosbuvir and ribavirin is not adequate for patients with cirrhosis. When we extend in the next set to 16 weeks with sofosbuvir and ribavirin, we get higher up. But it's really only on the right side of the graph where we do start to see the response rates in the 90%+ range that we expect. And if we move to the discussion of the Boson study on the right there, this was an interesting study that did include patients with genotype 2 and cirrhosis. And we saw that when given sofosbuvir with peg interferon and ribavirin for 12 weeks, we're at 94%. The sofosbuvir and ribavirin at 16 weeks is down there at 87%, but when you extend that to 24 weeks, we're at 100%. And that led to the changes in the guidance document. On the next slide, we have some data about dacladaspir and sofosbuvir in genotype 2. And really, there's minimal data here in patients with cirrhosis. But we do have to extrapolate from other data sets. And this is a pan-genotypic regimen, and so I think it is appropriate to do that here. So we do know from a phase 2 study, which there were 26 patients, rather, in which 24 of the 26, or 92%, achieved SPR when treated for 24 weeks. The co-infection study on the right there in green only had 11 patients who were genotype 2. They received treatment for 12 weeks, and that was a 100% SPR rate. But we do have to, again, accept there's minimal data in patients with cirrhosis, and ASLE IDSA guidance recommends that we consider 24 weeks and ribavirin if the patient has cirrhosis. In the next part, I want to talk about genotype 3, and we've known for a while now that's been a challenging population. The table here summarizes the current ASLD, IDSA, IAS, USA guidance. So if the patient's treatment naive, sofosbuvir and ribavirin is no longer the recommended regimen. It's now been relegated to alternative status. Recommended includes peg interferon alpha, ribavirin, and sofosbuvir for 12 weeks, or dacladaspir and sofosbuvir for 12 weeks. And if the patient has cirrhosis, 24 weeks with consideration of ribavirin. If the patient's a peg interferon ribavirin non-responder, then the patient is recommended, again, to consider the peg interferon ribavirin and sofosbuvir option for 12 weeks. Or we can consider dacladaspir and sofosbuvir again for 12 weeks, or that 24 weeks of cirrhosis with ribavirin for those treatment failure patients. And for the sofosbuvir failures, they again can consider the 12-week peg interferon regimen, or they could consider dacladaspir and sofosbuvir for 24 weeks, and again, with ribavirin. And on the next slide, again, I have a kind of a summary to give you a sense of these different studies and kind of how they add up. The blue bars are the patients without cirrhosis. The green bars are the patients with cirrhosis. We have both treatment naive on the left and then treatment experienced on the right. And we have data here from valence, Ally3, boson. And general take-home things are that patients without cirrhosis are doing quite well with a number of different options, but we really have struggled in these patients with cirrhosis, and particularly treatment-experienced patients with cirrhosis. So if we move to the right side of the graph, we see that for interferon ribavirin failures, that Dacladaspir Sofosbuvir for 12 weeks does well in patients without cirrhosis, but down there at 69% in patients with cirrhosis. And when we move to the 12-week regimen of Sofosbuvir, Peg, Interferon, and Ribavirin, we're at 94% without cirrhosis, 86% with cirrhosis. In boson, Sofosbuvir and Ribavirin was effective in 82% of patients without cirrhosis, but only 77% of patients with cirrhosis. You'll notice this is lower than was seen in the valent study of treatment naive patients as well. We also saw that Sofosbuvir and Ribavirin in valence was, for treatment experience, was 87%, but then 62% of the patients with cirrhosis. So this led to the overall recommendations that are in the guidance, in which we've really highlighted that peg interferon alpha ribavirin and sofosbuvir is a good option here if the patients can tolerate peg interferon. If not, then this is where Dacladaspir and sofosbuvir have a role, and it's recommended for longer duration with patients with cirrhosis, and the addition of ribavirin for the peg interferon ribavirin failures and the sofosbuvir failures. On the next slide, I'd like to go into a little bit more detail about the Dacladaspir sofosbuvir experience. So this is the Ally3 study, and these are genotype 3 patients who are treatment naive and experienced. The regimen here again is Dacladaspir, the NS5A inhibitor, 60 milligrams along with sofosbuvir for 12 weeks. And this included naive and treatment experienced patients, and we see that the patients without cirrhosis did very well, over 90%, whether naive or experienced. But for the patients with cirrhosis, we're at 58% when treatment naive and 69% when treatment experienced. And on the next slide, we get a little bit more information from Ally3 Plus, which was recently presented at the liver meeting. In this study, there were 50 patients, again genotype 3, and they either had advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis, and they were a mixture of treatment naive and treatment experienced patients. And the goal here really was to take this regimen, and it's the 3-plus study because we're looking at 12 weeks now, but also at 16 weeks. And what we saw was that SVR4 was 88% and 12 weeks, and then 96% in the 16-week arm. And this was lending more support for the longer course of therapy here for patients who had cirrhosis or advanced fibrosis in genotype 3 patients. When they further broke it down between advanced fibrosis and cirrhosis, we saw that that all the patients with advanced fibrosis were achieving SVR4, and cirrhosis is where we did start to see the relapse. So in the next session, I just want to talk broadly about patients with decompensated cirrhosis and how we approach them. And there are a number of questions that come up. Is the treatment safe? But also, how much better can the patients get? Will this be like hepatitis B and you treat their virus and their livers recover nicely? Or is it possible? Can they really get that much better? The ASLD-IDSA guidance has commented on this, and mainly with the point that these patients need to be referred to a medical practitioner with expertise, and ideally to a liver transplant center, so they can see if liver transplantation should be part of their plan. On the next slide, we go through that hepatic impairment does matter with some of the DAAs, and so even though we've talked about a number in this talk, some may or may not be appropriate. So sofosbuvir and ribavirin has no dose adjustment based upon your child PU class. For sofosbuvir with peg interferon and ribavirin, the issue there is the peg interferon, and so contraindicated if the patient's decompensated. Sofosbuvir ledibizumab also has no dose adjustment for child PU class. But as we talked about, paratepravir, bisoprolol, ritonavir with ambidispir and dasatinib is contraindicated in child PU, B, and C. Simeprevir and sofosbuvir is also not recommended in child PU, B, and C. And dacladaspir and sofosbuvir has no dose adjustment, and so another good regimen there. On the next study, I have some data from the SOLAR study. And this is a study of decompensated patients with child PU class B or C. They were genotypes 1 or 4 and treatment naive and experienced. And these were some pretty sick patients, so the bilirubin had to be 10 or less. Creatinine clearance had to be greater than 40. Platelets could be as low as 30,000. And it was a randomized control trial looking at ledibizumab sofosbuvir for 12 versus 24 weeks. The patients were started on 600 milligrams daily of ribavirin, and then they tried to titrate up to see if it was tolerated. And the overall SVR rates range from 86 to 90%. And we see reasonable results for both 12 weeks and 24 weeks, pretty comparable really, and also for both Child P, B, and C. And we have talked a lot about a 90% threshold for treatment, but these are very advanced patients where we would not have had anything to offer them before. And so it was very encouraging to see these response rates in this group. So on the next slide, we try to get into what does cure of hepatitis C mean? And this is looking at the MELD score in these patients and just to showing what their pre-transplant scores were. And we see that with treatment, some of the patients had a reduction in the MELD score. Some of the patients got a little bit better. Keep in mind, this is at the end of the follow-up period of the study and not necessarily after a longer-term period. But it is demonstrating there are a group of patients who are at least improving their MELD score somewhat in the short term. Again, the long term is key. And so on the next slide, I try to get into a little bit more of this discussion about how do we guide patients on this right now? Is there a threshold where we cannot avoid a transplant? If your MELD score is a certain number, should we just say, listen, hepatitis C therapy is not for you right now. You should just go ahead and defer. You could even take a hepatitis C positive organ and decrease your waiting time. And then we can treat you after transplant, knowing full well that the outcomes for post-transplant are excellent. There may be some patients who are either not eligible for transplant or may not want to get hepatitis C transplant. And now at least we have regimens that they can tolerate and are quite effective for them. And so we need to have those discussions with our patients. So in summary, there's a number of issues when thinking about patients with hepatitis C and cirrhosis. So all patients with hepatitis C need an assessment of fibrosis. And the patients with advanced fibrosis and cirrhosis should be prioritized for treatment. They're at risk for progression of their liver disease sooner than other groups, and so we need to focus on them. Hepatitis C treatment is safe and effective in patients with compensated cirrhosis, and we can feel comfortable in that regard. For patients with decompensated cirrhosis, they should be referred to an experienced clinician and preferably a liver transplant center to see if they may want to consider that option. Antiviral treatment can be effective, but must consider the transplant options in the treatment plan. And some agents are not recommended or contraindicated in patients with decompensated cirrhosis. This has been the ISA USA module on the treatment of hepatitis C in patients with cirrhosis. I'm Andrew Muir, and thank you for listening.